My subject is the Russian preoccupation with history, or rather, not so much with history as with patterns of history, with historicism, with the laws of history, with the idea that history in some sense is subject to some kind of pattern which is inexorable and inevitable, through which all human groups, nations, cultures must necessarily go. I don't, of course, mean that all Russians believed this or were influenced by it, only that rather central figures in the 19th century were who, in some ways, created an atmosphere in which later intellectual developments, culminating in the Russian Revolution, developed an atmosphere in which the ideology of the revolution found it particularly easy to flourish. Let me try and begin by trying to explain the situation in Russia itself, as I see it, in which these ideas developed. First of all, one might ask, why do people study history at all? There are many motives for this. Sometimes it's just a question of solidarity amongst a community. We're all the sons of Cadmus. We all come from Troy. We're all the children of Abraham. We're all descended from some mythical dragon. Therefore, we're all brothers, and we all belong to the same group of mankind. That is certainly one of the most powerful motives for believing in history, both mythological and genuine. Then, of course, there are patriotic reasons. There is the sense of past glory which buoys us up in difficult moments. There is the sense of the voices of our ancestors, of the great national tradition to which a given society feels or wants to belong. Then there is the whole notion that history is somehow a school for morals, that it shows human beings behaving in various ways in the past, from which one can draw certain lessons for the present. It shows virtue and vice. This is the kind of thing which Leibniz and Voltaire, and indeed Thucydides and Hume and Buckle and all kinds of philosophers of history and historians certainly suppose themselves to be studying history for. Then there is the motive of simply collecting material for some kind of natural science, say sociology, just historical material for the purpose of discovering whether there are some laws which govern human history, much as they govern nature. Well, there's also the question, for example, of what constitutes progress and what constitutes reaction, sort of way in which Voltaire studied history, to show humanity in its finest or brightest hours as against its darkest and worst hours. People to some kind of ideal mode of it before them, and contrast that with moments of retrogression and barbarism. There is also the view of history as a kind of drama, perhaps a great divine play in which all kinds of mysterious periods succeed each other, which is in some sense, at least, the story of God's word to man, the way in which human history is conducted by its divine maker. The sense in which the Russians took, Russians whose names I am about to mention, is not quite any of these. They were chiefly influenced by that school of German historical philosophy which developed towards the end of the 18th century, in accordance with which men were made what they were by belonging to societies, and these societies in turn developed organically as plants or animals do, in accordance with certain discoverable laws or principles. And what a man was largely depended on the kind of society to which he belonged. The very idea of belonging, the very idea that a man develops most fruitfully and most happily amongst people with whom he is in some special way associated, by means of kinship, by means of common culture, by means of common language, by means of common memories. The idea that people only develop properly in the midst of their own proper culture, that kind of thing, which the German philosopher Herder was chiefly responsible for propagating. That was the sense of history which particularly influenced the Russians. You may ask, which Russians and why? Well, let me begin by explaining that very few, if any, ideas outside the realms of natural science and outside perhaps art itself were born on Russian soil. For the most part, Russians borrowed ideas from the West and then took them very seriously. And in taking them very seriously, altered them. Nothing alters ideas so profoundly as being taken with utter seriousness by people who believe in them and try and lead their lives accordingly. And when these ideas were transformed simply by the deep faith in them, which these people had, they ricochet back onto Europe, apparently in a new guise. This is certainly what happened with certain ideas of socialism, and it happened also with ideas of history. Here was this great country, full of untried energy, with a tiny educated class, with a small bureaucracy trying to govern a huge, ignorant peasant population, living in a condition of semi-barbarism, ignorance, and squalor. Removed from the main currents of Western civilization by the great schism which bound them to the Greek church, precipitated into Europe by the invasion of Napoleon. Feared and admired by Europe, admired for its vast strength as the greatest material power in Europe at the beginning of the 19th century, at the same time despised as a great mass of uneducated barbarians, Cossacks, themselves filled with pride at their magnificent repulsion of the great French conqueror whom nobody had before managed so utterly to defeat, and at the same time terribly conscious of their barbarism, their ignorance, their lack of education in comparison with the great educated countries of Germany and France through which the victorious Russians marched in 1814 and 15. If you can imagine that, you can also easily conceive that these people looked to the West for such culture, such civilization as could be obtained. In, as I say, a mood at once of envy and pride, inferiority culturally, and at the same time nervous of being over-despised, resentful about being regarded as a huge barbarian mass, in a mixed mood, in other words, of envy and resentment. Well, the kind of ideas which were prevalent in the West at this particular period sprang largely out of what is normally called the Romantic movement. I don't propose to try and summarize this movement in the little time that I have before me. Let me confine myself to this, that one of the central concepts of the Romantic movement was that every man and every human group had some kind of goal for which, in some sense, it was created, some kind of end or mission to fulfill which was its very essence, its very nature. That it was perfectly proper of such human groups, more particularly nations or cultures, to ask themselves what would fulfill them most richly. What was the quintessence of their nature, and in what particular direction were they, so to speak, intended by that nature to flower? This was perhaps a notion that was born of a certain degree of inferiority, particularly in the case of the Germans, who felt humiliated by the French throughout, for example, the late 16th and 17th centuries. The Germans, who felt themselves to be both materially and culturally inferior to the dominant French, were sooner or later to ask themselves whether they really were as poor a people as they were evidently thought to be by their triumphant Western neighbors, the French and to some extent the English, and naturally came up, as all human groups despised or patronized for too long, with the notion that they could not be as inferior as they were thought to be, that they too had their place in the world, they too had some goal for which God or nature had created them, perhaps a superior goal, perhaps a higher destiny than that which these mocking successful civilizations evidently themselves prided themselves on. Well, the Russians were even more deeply in this condition. The first thinker to ask himself this question was an interesting man called Peter Chardaev, a guards officer, an elegant, handsome, rather arrogant man, friend of the great poet Pushkin, exceedingly well educated, who traveled abroad, read French and German easily, and was at once fascinated by German metaphysics and by the then current Masonic and other religious and quasi-religious movements. Chardaev was a man who, sometime after the terrible trauma of the failure of the Decembrist revolt against the Tsar, in which he was obliquely implicated, asked himself, what do we exist for? What is the particular purpose of the Russian nation? He wrote a famous series of letters called Philosophical Letters, of which only one was printed in the late 30s, in which he said, what is our goal? Where are we going? We know what Western culture is. It's a magnificent human achievement. From the days of the Greeks and the Romans onwards, first Greece, then Rome, then the great Roman Church, which preserved the cultural conquests and attainments of the classical age. This is the great model, this is the true culture to which all human beings naturally wish to attain. What about us? What have we? When we look at our past, we discover almost nothing. Here we are, wandering Slav tribes. And after our wanderings, what? Pale imitators of Byzantium in a period of decline. And then what? The Tatar yoke which crushed us and humiliated us and brutalized us. And then what? The Tsars of Muscovy, Ivan the Terrible, arbitrary tyranny, cruelty, blood, the knout. And then what? The 18th century, Peter the Great, were nothing but tame imitators of the West, aping and parroting Western values without fully understanding them. That is our past. In short, our past is contemptible. There is nothing in it. It's empty. What are we? We're nothing but a blank page on which anybody who wishes chooses to write whatever he wishes. And what is to be our future? Who can tell? Why were we created? Every other nation has achieved something, but we? Where is our literature? Where is our art? Where is our great past achievement on which we can look with pride? Perhaps we're simply a caution created by God to warn other nations of what not to do, where not to go. Well, one can imagine that this terrible, self-lacerating letter denouncing Russia for being culturally null produced the effect of shock and indignation, indeed, on some of his contemporaries. The church and the state were equally indignant, and the Emperor Nicholas I caused him to be pronounced mad, confined to his house, visited by a doctor weekly, a punishment which has since then not been entirely unknown in the case of other cultural dissidents. Well, Tchardaev was the first of these. The importance of Tchardaev is this, that he was the first person to pose certain questions to which the rest of 19th century Russian thought and literature is to some degree one great continuous answer. The note of breastbeating, the note of self-denigration, plus the question, whither are we going? What is to be the future of Russia? What is the destiny of Russia? These questions became obsessive to the whole of the Russian 19th century. Almost every Russian novelist who writes about what it is to be a Russian, castigates Russian vices, celebrates Russian virtues, and invariably is preoccupied with the question of what Russia is, what it ought to be, where it ought to go. When the Russian writer Korolenko, at the beginning of the 20th century, said something like, my country is not Russia, my country is Russian literature, everybody knew what he meant. He meant that it's Russian literature with its obsessive self-criticism, with its questions of what Russia should be, why Russia was what it was the natural home of what might be called self-conscious, critical Russian thought. It wouldn't have meant anything if, say, Somerset Maugham said, my country is not England, my country is English literature. Nobody would have known what Anatole France meant if he'd said, my country is not France, my country is French literature. But in the case of Russia, it was perfectly plain what these people meant. The revolutionary Alexander Herzen had already said, Russian literature is simply one enormous, continuous indictment of Russian life. Now, this is begun by Tchardaev. Let me explain that it is countries which feel themselves inferior, which feel that they have a great deal of health and strength and no culture to lean on, countries which were brought up by a church with no real intellectual tradition, which is what happened in the case of the Greek Orthodox Church. Lives of saints, holy living, yes, but no great scholastic tradition like the Roman Church. Countries, therefore, which come to the feast of Europe, of the European nations, lacking those intellectual and those cultural qualities which they feel they ought to contribute and therefore feel inferior, countries like this, which are inevitably forced to ask themselves, what is to become of us? Where are we going? This isn't done by successful societies. You don't get Dickens saying, whither England? You don't get Stendhal saying, whither France. But almost every Russian writer is preoccupied with this question. Russian novels, Russian poetry is filled with it. And Chardaev is the first person to sound this note, to put forward what were later called the accursed questions of Russian life with which any responsible Russian was expected to cope. Now, once the question was posed, it could no longer be avoided. And one of the natural answers to this was to look in history. Perhaps by looking at the past of European nations, or of Russia herself, we shall discover some pattern which will tell us what the next step is. This is quite a natural thing to believe, particularly if you are under the influence of romantic conception of history, historicism, in the way in which many German thinkers, of course, in the first instance, Hegel, but also opponents of Hegel, like the, say, historical lawyers of Germany, who believed that laws were created out of the gradual organic growth of custom underneath the crust or surface of life, and that within this organic growth, a pattern could be traced which was due to history itself, against which one mustn't proceed because our very natures are made what they are by the peculiarities of our historical development. If that is the kind of movement, the kind of vision of life which is prevalent, there's nothing more natural than that the Russians should ask themselves, and we, what is our pattern? What should we be doing? And then there is disagreement. On the one hand, there are, for example, the so-called Slavophiles who say, yes, there is a pattern of life. We know what to do because we are not as other nations are. Someone like Ivan Kireevsky or someone like Khovyakov, these are semi-theological Russian philosophers of history, explain, we mustn't imitate the West. The West is decadent. The West is rotting. The French Revolution was a condign punishment upon the strayings of the West, as some Western Catholic thinkers, De Maistre, Bonald, and others, have quite rightly said. The West was developed by some kind of mechanical, despotic pattern of which the Roman Church is, in some sense, the now somewhat degenerate embodiment. The free human spirit, caught by this great bureaucratic order, this huge pyramid which the Roman Church constitutes, was stifled and squeezed into compartments in which nothing truly creative, nothing truly spontaneous, nothing truly human could properly develop, except in a rather constricted and maimed way. And the revolt against it by the Protestants was quite natural, but that went to the opposite extreme. Instead of at least some collective, some united movement of mankind, which after all the Roman Church had promoted during the unified Christendom of the Middle Ages, we now have nothing but an atomized individualism in which each man stands for himself, in which each man jealously guards his own privacy against others, in which men do not behave like brothers, men do not behave with love and affection for each other, but with suspicious protection of their rights. Any talk of rights always means that a society of this kind is in some way disintegrated. Men erect walls against each other instead of that loving society which is the true goal of men, and which only the Orthodox Church, which was free from the ossifying influence of the Roman Church, free from the disintegrating influence of the Reformation, managed to realize. It is within the Orthodox Church that spontaneity, the free human spirit, the creativity can truly assert itself. And therefore, if you say, what is the fate of Russia, which way must we develop, we must look to the Greek fathers of the Church. We must look to the origins of Christianity in Byzantium. We must look to this particular pattern which allows for free and loving development of men not subject to some destructive and ossifying political framework under which the nations of the West are at present groaning. That was the Slavophil sermon. Against this came the Westernizers, who said, not at all, we are, our condition is fearful. We have nothing but, Chardaev is perfectly right. All we have is serfdom, ignorance, lack of resources, poverty, oppression, arbitrariness at the top, obsequiousness from below. On the contrary, we must learn from the West. Every nation goes through the same stages of development, but we are at a very primitive and very early stage of it. We must therefore go through those stages which the West has already gone through, and by the means of which it has developed its splendid civilization. We are barbarians knocking at the door, and unless we go through all the stages which the West has gone through, how can we ever reach their level of development in science, in politics, in art, in every province of the human spirit in which we are quite obviously so lacking? Some thinkers, obsessed by this, ask themselves rather wistfully, need we go through all the most painful stages of Western progress? Must we go, for example, through all the horrors of the Industrial Revolution, all the exploitation and degradation of human beings, which quite evidently happened in England, for example, towards the end of the 18th century and is happening there now? Must we really go through this? Or is it perhaps possible in some way to circumnavigate this? Is it possible for our village communes to enter into some kind of advanced technology without going through the terrible hell, the intermediate hell of the frightful exploitation, the terrible human cost through which the Western nations in the course of their industrial development seem to have gone? Now, these questions, quite apart from what the answers to them are all set in what might be called a historical framework. The assumption always is, if we can only discover what the pattern of history is, then we shall understand ourselves, we understand where we belong, we understand what the next move is. If we don't attend to these historical patterns, we shall make terrible mistakes. It's only by understanding what is the proper ladder of human development that we shall know which rung we're on. And if we don't ask this question, then we might very well try to get onto some wrong rung, some rung which has already been passed, or some rung which we're not yet mature enough to be able to get onto. And this will surely lead to disaster. The only way in which we can progress properly is by understanding the reality with which we're dealing. And this reality is historically conditioned. And this notion of a ladder, this notion that there are certain stages, that we must know what stage we've arrived at. Are we at stage 12 or are we at stage 74? What is the next move, so to speak, which is objectively dictated to us by the very movement of history? This is something which becomes quite obsessive among certain thinkers in Russia. Of course, these things were discussed in the West also. I don't mean to say they were not. But there it was to some extent simply books which were written by various thinkers, conversations in intellectual salons. It didn't really make difference to what might be called the central thought or even action of these countries. In Russia, it does seem to me to have done so. Take, for example, a very central thinker in Russian social thought, the literary critic Vissarion Belinsky. Vissarion Belinsky really lived his intellectual ideas in a very painful and very agonized fashion. And this is characteristic of the kind of Russian intellectuals of whom I speak. They really took ideas with utter seriousness. He began by supposing that the Russians were ill-educated, unformed, immature, and therefore the monarchy, the paternalistic despotism of Nicholas I is all that barbarians of this kind could for the moment expect, because if they were liberated, they would create some kind of chaos. This is roughly what a number of reactionary foreign thinkers like Demestre certainly said about Russia, and that is how Belinsky began. Then he moved from this to the ideas derived from German metaphysicians that perhaps empirical life, everyday life, was of no importance. What mattered was the life of the spirit, which soared above everyday life. And if one could live in some ideal world, of which Fichte had spoken, of which the playwright and philosopher Schiller had spoken, then I think that is all that a man who really sought to understand the truth, who sought to realize all the potentialities within him, could do, and ignore the life of the masses, the life of the Philistine bourgeoisie, which could not attain to such heights. But being a man of acute conscience, being a man extremely sensitive to the sufferings of others, and with an extremely developed sense of moral responsibility for the misfortunes and the injustices to others, he couldn't long linger in this particular condition. He then crossed over to a Hegelian position. As he understood Hegel, if one understood history properly, then all the things which one normally condemned, all the injustices, all the horrors, all the cruelties, all the abominations of history, what he called Philip II of Spain, the Inquisition, the brutalities, the injustices of tyrants, all these things could be seen to be inevitable stages in the ascent of mankind. Once you understood that these things could not be avoided, not only did you comprehend why they happened, but you also saw that they were all indispensable to the higher harmony to which mankind was striving. And you ceased to resist them. You ceased to denounce them. You ceased to kick against them. To understand was to accept. And for a time, Belinsky tried to justify all the abominations and horrors, as they seemed to him before, of Russian history, and indeed of the history of other nations also, on the ground that if one ascended to a higher vantage point, one could see that all these apparent disharmonies, all these clashes, all these phenomena which seemed so ugly and so discordant, if you saw them by themselves without relating them to others, were in fact ingredients of higher harmony, and seen in the larger context of the whole of history, they were seen to be necessary elements in the ultimate self-understanding, self-liberation, and triumph of the human spirit. Well, and for this reason, it was childish, it was uneducated, it was in some sense ungrown up simply to kick against these necessary pricks. But of course, being a man of extreme sensibility, being a man of tender conscience, being a man ultimately who couldn't bear to stifle his moral intuitions too strongly, he rebelled against this and said in the end that he couldn't accept it, that he was not prepared for the sake of some historical theory to condone all the brutalities and the horrors, to see his brothers rolling about in the mud, to see all the blood and the injustice and the fearful vices and abominations of Russian society around him, simply because some philosopher or other said that this was necessary for some higher ideal. To the devil with a higher ideal. What one must do is to cure the immediate pains, the immediate sufferings on earth. And I'm only talking about Bielinski not so much because of the intrinsic interest of his own ideas, but because this wasn't familiar in the West. Bielinski tried to live his ideas. He tried to coerce his own consciousness. He tried to impose upon himself a new attitude towards human beings, towards art, towards literature, for which he cared most deeply, towards the political structure, towards moral and social ideas. He tried to, in some way, force them into the framework of what on other grounds he believed to be correct. And the more difficult, the more painful, the more against his whole nature it was, the more he believed he had to do it. It's only if you force yourself to accept conclusions which appear unpalatable that you show true intellectual seriousness, true moral courage. This was typically Russian in some ways. And the fact that he rejected it in the end was simply creditable to his heart and to his moral consciousness. Well, what I mean is this. You don't in the West find comparable phenomena, perhaps because the West was successful and Russia was, so to speak, backward. When a Russian thinker like Bielinski, or a Russian thinker like Herzen, at one period of his life at least, tries to justify a given reform, tries to justify a given course of action, is in favor of reform against revolution, or revolution against reform, they try and justify it on historical grounds. They say, this is the pattern of history. As I say, we've reached stage 34, and therefore the next step is 35 and 36. We can't do 62 until we've been through the 40s and the 50s, or through all the rungs on the ladder. You don't get that in the West. You don't get John Stuart Mill or somebody of that sort, if he's in favor of some kind of reform, saying, what stage of history have we reached? Where is England on the ladder of progress? You don't even get so passionate and so Germanic a thinker as Carlyle asking this. When Michelet denounces the Jesuits or denounces Napoleon III, he doesn't do it in the name of the fact that we've reached stage 17 and the next stage in the ascent of mankind must be stage 18. He does it simply because he thinks that Napoleon III is a tyrant, or because he thinks that the Jesuits are monsters of some kind. And when Mill or Carlyle or Gladstone, whoever it might be, speaks about this or that as having to be done, the arguments are political, empirical, moral, but not historical in character. This reliance on history, this attempt to make history the authority, is some kind of attempt to convert history into a theodicy, to substitute the historical pattern for what had in earlier days had been some kind of religious revelation, what in earlier days had been the authority of a church which in Russia had evidently grown weak and somewhat compromised by its ignorance and its subservience to the state. After Bielinski, you have someone like Chernyshevsky, who's a radical revolutionary thinker, who says, can we circumnavigate the industrial regime? Could we go straight from the village commune to some kind of form of the kind of socialism which he believes in? And his reply is somewhat ambivalent. He says, no, we must go through the same stages as the West. We're not peculiar, we're not unique. It is what the Slavophils say about our uniqueness because of we're not Catholics or Protestants, all this has nothing to do with the case. The factors which dominate history are economic and material, not religious and spiritual in the first place. And then he does think that, as a matter of fact, one can circumnavigate these factors, but only if certain steps are taken. Herzen, on the other hand, says, has history a libretto? Is there some scenario here? Do we have to obey it? He ends by saying, no, he doesn't think history does have a libretto. No, the human will, voluntarism, is more important. We can't confine history within the framework of our own puny historical theories. It doesn't so much matter what these people say, whether you believe in some kind of historical pattern, as Chernyshevsky does, or try to deny it in the name of some kind of free, voluntary action by individuals convinced of the value of the girls which they pursue, like Herzen, it doesn't so much matter which it is they say. The point is they always have to come to terms with some kind of historicism. They always have to answer the question one way or the other in the way in which Western thinkers evidently do not appear to have to do. Well, Chernyshevsky develops the theory, for example, that backwardness may have its own advantages. This comes from Chardaev himself, the very man who denounced Russia for being nothing but darkness, barbarism, and the knout. After being pronounced mad, wrote another book in which he said, well, called Apologie d'un Fou, Apology of a Madman, in which he said, maybe I was mistaken. Maybe God has created Russia for a special fate. Maybe the fact that we are backward means that we are fresh, we are young, we are unexhausted. Perhaps we shall be able to profit by the attainments of the decaying West in the way in which the West is too feeble to do. And Chernyshevsky takes up this theme and seizes it. So do other Russian thinkers. Perhaps there's a certain virtue in backwardness. One needn't go through all the agonies of, say, industrialism in order to profit by its results. One needn't have to invent the machinery oneself. One needn't put out a lot of laborers and make them unemployed and cause all the fearful social suffering which this causes. One needn't have the laborers at all. Perhaps one can use the latest products of European industrialism and graft them on to our system, which fortunately has no proletariat. Perhaps we can do without creating proletarians. Perhaps a peasant society can in some way centralize itself sufficiently to be able to use the industrial attainments of the West. And so it goes on. And this, of course, this theory that backwardness is of a certain value, because there are certain inexorable stages, but you are allowed to pluck the fruit of a tree grown by other people, becomes an obsessive theme. First Chernyshevsky says it, then people say it toward the end of the 19th century, people say it in the 20th century, and finally contemporary thinkers like Isaac Deutscher say it. And a great many developing nations in Africa and in Asia believe in exactly that even now. In fact, there obviously is some deep connection between being technologically inferior and looking to history to see what one can do. In some way, history offers a prop. It offers some kind of encouragement to proceed in a certain direction, which successful societies don't feel because they can simply ask themselves, what is the rational thing to do, without particularly bothering about alleged patterns to which they look as some kind of salvation. You find this particular reliance upon history at all stages of Russian social thought in the mid-19th century. For example, you have quite an interesting argument between two revolutionaries, Tkachev and Lavrov, in the 70s about what one should do about bringing about a Russian revolution. Well, Tkachev, who doesn't really much believe in history, who is a kind of Jacobin, who believes in creating a small professional revolutionary elite and making a revolution when and as we can, Tkachev says, the peasants cannot help us. Peasants are reactionary and peasants are stupid. They will always betray us. The only way to make a revolution in Russia, to stop the injustice and the inefficiency that is going on, is by a small, properly trained body of revolutionaries who will organize a revolt and impose it upon the population, whether it likes it or not, for its benefit, for it, but without its help. But Lavrov, who is a gradualist, argues historically. He says, but this cannot be. This would be making a revolution before we are ready. This is premature. If we do this, you will find that in order to defend ourselves against the inevitable counter-revolution of the very peasants for whose benefit we've made the revolution, but who may not appreciate its value, you will find that you will have to arm yourself. You will have to impose a yoke upon them. You will have to coerce them. In this course of this, you will brutalize yourself. In the course of fighting off the counter-revolutionaries, you will turn yourself into the very kinds of despot whom you are now, with every justice, trying to destroy in Russia. Until enough Russians have understood what the virtues of the new system, of the socialist system, are, until they have become educated, until, as it were, history itself has moved forward to the point at which a revolution is possible, we mustn't do it. This is a direct appeal to history. This is parallel to Engels, who says nothing is worse than a premature revolution, because that must inevitably lead to despotism. So again, when Bakunin, who doesn't believe in history, who believes in simply destroying the hated system and then trusting to the natural goodness and spontaneity of human nature with the chains knocked off to create a happier and freer universe, Bakunin is attacked by Herzen, who says, this won't do. History has its own temper, which you must observe. You cannot build a home for free men out of the bricks from which a prison house was built. If you liberate them too soon, you will find that the petty bourgeois values against which you are operating, the very philistinism, the horrors which you are trying to eliminate, will reassert themselves on the part of the very victors, who will have been brought up by these Philistines and Philistine ideas. Until they've been internally liberated, they will not create a free world. What I wish to stress is that the argument always proceeds along some kind of historicist lines, along some sort of lines of there being some sort of clock. And one has to know which hour has been reached. The whole notion of putting the clock back, not going too far forward, this whole notion obsesses the Russians. The notion of a ladder, the notion of certain rungs as following each other in some kind of inexorable order, the calendar, which we mustn't anticipate. So you can imagine that when Marxism finally came upon the European scene, it found a marvelously fertile soil in Russia, of all countries, which had already been prepared by this obsession with historical notions. Marxism was particularly congenial, because not only did it emphasize what Russians both of the right and left tended to believe, both right-wing historians like Chicherin and left-wing revolutionaries like Chernyshevsky, though they might hate each other, equally accepted the patterns of history. Not only did it look like powerful economic arguments in favor of this particular form of pattern of discoverable laws of human progress, but also it tied them to the notion of natural science, toward which the Russians were naturally extremely respectful. It also promised a happy ending, and it also gave very good, even better arguments than before, for loathing the irrational, oppressive, and arbitrary government which was restraining the Russian society from realizing its full potential and attaining to rationality and freedom. Well, it was immediately, of course, opposed by those who were frightened of the idea of some kind of rigorous determinism. The socialist critic Mikhailovsky said, "I don't wish to be the toe of the foot of some enormous giant called history, so that I have no liberty at all, so that I am operated by it, so that I don't choose but am chosen for, so that I have no real liberty of action but am simply a cog in some vast machine." Darwin, Marx tell me this, but it isn't true. There is such a thing as human freedom, there is the human will. All the greatest attainments of mankind were made by men who operated in a free medium, not coerced into it, not conditioned into it, not determined by some vast pattern from which they couldn't escape. The Marxist Plekhanov argued against that and said, not at all. There is an absolutely rigorous order of historical progress, and we have now reached the point at which the Russian capitalism is emerging. Instead of trying to circumnavigate it, which is naive and impossible, we must help it along. We must, in fact, almost egg on capitalism so that the ultimate destruction of capitalism, which is equally inevitable, occurs sooner. Capitalists, as Marx said, are their own grave diggers. The more rapidly they develop in our backward country, the more rapidly they will dig their own graves. Therefore, so far from obstructing them, as various populists and people with agricultural mystiques want to do for fear of the growth of capitalist system, we must, on the contrary, hurry it on, in some sense help it. Well, of course, this was a very bitter pill to swallow for people who said, how can we help our own exploiters? You are asking us to actually to assist in the process of exploitation, of creating a proletariat? Yes, said Plekhanov. No proletariat, no revolution. That is what Marx said, and Marx, if you read his works, is perfectly right. There's no avoiding his conclusions. When, for example, there was a crisis in the Russian Social Democratic Party as a result of this, the free will problem to which I've now come is, of course, something which has always obsessed individual thinkers. But it never became an issue for a political party to the degree to which it did in Russia. Individual philosophers might be troubled about it, individual men, but there were Russian social democrats who said, if history is inevitable, if the stages follow each other with absolutely irreversible necessity, then why should we risk our lives, and certainly our liberties, in fighting against the regime which kills us and sends us to Siberia and maims us and arrests us and obstructs us in every way, if it's going to happen anyhow? Maybe it'll take a little longer. But why should we take these vast risks for some kind of conclusion which history will furnish in any case? And the then socialist leader Struve actually had to put forward the proposition that while 90% of life was indeed causally determined, 10% was free. And within this 10% it was possible to make the revolution. Now, my point is, in no other country did this have to be done. Monsieur Jules Guesde, who was leader of the Marxists in France, Karl Kautsky, the leader of the Marxists in Germany, English socialists, Sidney Webb or Beatrice, were not bothered by the problem of free will. But in Russia, because ideas were taken seriously, and because history was taken seriously, and because therefore historical determinism was taken seriously, the Russian socialists actually had to be told it was useful, evidently, to say to them, we're not 100% determined. There is a realm of freedom in which it is possible for heroes, heroic revolutionaries, to be martyred for the sake of something, and not for the sake of something which will happen in any case, whether they suffer or not. So again, the Russian populists wrote letters to Karl Marx in London and said, do we have to go through industrialism? Can't we perhaps achieve socialism by our own methods, by means of the famous peasant commune, the Mir? And at first Marx, of course, didn't really want to listen to this, but in the end, he conceded that perhaps, under certain conditions, if there is a world revolution and the like, it might be that revolutionary activities in Russia might lead to the emergence of a socialist order in Russia, even though they would not have to go through all the industrial path of the West. Well, when Marx made this concession, Plekhanov, who was the leader of the Russian Marxists, thought that this would upset the party far too much. It would create chaos. People wouldn't any longer accept the central foundation of Marxist socialism, namely the inevitable determination of historical stages by economic development, by the class war, and therefore actually suppressed the letter. It was only printed, I think, only published somewhere in around 1923. Now, my point is, nowhere in the West would this be necessary. It wouldn't be necessary for French socialists or German socialists actually to suppress a letter by Marx for fear that their party might become demoralized or thrown into confusion. But in Russia, these things were taken with the most passionate literalness, and therefore the situation really was spiritually different from the West. That is the point which I wish to make. It's so even in the case of Lenin, that most faithful disciple of Marx, a man of revolutionary temperament, and naturally a man like that would suffer from a certain impatience if he was told there was quite a long period of industrialization, quite a long period during which Russia would have to cease to be an agricultural country, would have to generate a proletariat which in its turn would have to become the majority of the population if all the conditions laid down by Marx for a successful socialist revolution were to emerge. And so in 1896, as a young man of 26, Lenin tries to make out that the Russians have already reached this stage. He says, after all, peasants are in some sense capitalists. They're private owners of land. Can't we say that Russia is 90% capitalist? Isn't that all that Marx ever asked for? Can't we regard the peasants as capitalist in his sense of the word? Now, it doesn't matter about the validity or invalidity of this doctrine. Even he came very soon to realize that what he was saying bore no relation to reality, Marxist or any other. But the very fact that it had to be fitted into the framework of some kind of theory of historical development shows that this is what mattered. It mattered to him in 1905 when the question arose, shall we or shall we not make a revolution? And the question was, are we ripe or are we not? The very idea of ripeness, the very idea of have we reached the 1848 or have we reached 1870? Are we on rung 17 or are we on rung 23? Is something characteristically Russian. When Trotsky, at the beginning of the revolution, says contemptuously to the socialist leader Martov, you must go to where you belong, the rubbish heap of history. You're obsolete, in other words. You no longer are relevant to what is going on. The very idea of this rubbish heap, the very idea that history casts off people to the right and left into some kind of obsolete waste paper baskets, that we have to be of our time, that one can always tell who is backward, who is forward, who is where, presupposes some kind of fairly rigorous historical pattern in terms of which you can, as it were, classify people. Other people didn't talk like this. Well, even later, I think even Stalin, as late as 1947, at least officially, executed a certain number of people for, according to him, denying the inexorable economic laws which govern history and indulging in a heresy called voluntarism, which means, in some sense, ignoring or defying these laws of history. So that in the name of these historical laws, you can kill, you can destroy, as you would not be allowed to do in terms of ordinary social morality. Well, I'm not trying to say that every Russian thinker, so to speak, was in this sense obsessed by historicism, only that there is a central tradition, both on the right and the left, which created conditions in which Marxism developed with particular fertility, with particular success on Russian soil. Not, of course, all Russian revolutionary thinkers were historicists. Bakunin was not, Pisarev was not, Tkachev was not, Mikhailovsky was not. I've mentioned these people. These are people who were free of it, but they weren't central figures, at least not as central as those who were. Bakunin was the founder of anarchism, but anarchism never really took root in Russia to any profound extent. What took root in Russia was historicist Marxism. Tkachev was a splendid Jacobin figure, but his followers in Russia became fewer and fewer. And what really won was the great historical movement culminating in the Second Revolution of 1917. Tolstoy was not a historicist. He didn't believe in the laws of history in the least. But even he had to come to terms with it. That is my point. In that famous epilogue to War and Peace, in which he discusses the nature of history, he felt that he had to say something on the subject, if only to refute what he regarded as absurd views of bogus Western science, whatever it is he regarded it as. In fact, the whole of this kind of talk about history, not really about history, but about historicism, not really about history, but about meta-history, about patterns of history, about whether there were laws of history which had to be known in order to make rational progress possible. This kind of talk goes right through the 19th and 20th centuries. The determinists look on the libertarians as irrationalists, utopians, unrealistic, soft-headed. The libertarians look on the determinists as doctrinaires, people who twist facts in order to fit them into the theory, fanatical men who disregard human issues in order to force the poor, resistant human material into some kind of historical framework, which is in fact bogus, which is in fact unreal, which is in fact simply the fruit of some kind of false metaphysical theory, and so on. And this is the one country in which this battle really has high historical significance. Maybe this is true of backward countries in general. Maybe this is true of countries in Africa and Asia too today, all of which in some sense ask themselves, so to speak, at what stage industrialism should begin. The whole talk of imperatives of industrialization, of launching pads, in Mr. Rostow's sense, the whole talk, as it were, of going through certain stages, imitating countries which have done it before, and asking oneself what stage we've reached and what do we do next, so to speak, which I'm sure Marxist thinkers in Africa and in Asia ask themselves. This may be actually the result, so to speak, of a certain relative backwardness, which then naturally fastens on some kind of inevitable historical pattern as something which guarantees ultimate triumph and success. All I wish to say here now is that this preoccupation with the structure of history, quite apart from its validity or invalidity, is something which appears to me to be peculiar to the Russians and to ricochet from them onto the rest of the world. It comes from the West, of course. It comes from the Germans. It comes from Hegel. It comes from Saint-Simon in France. It comes perhaps from some of the thinkers even of the French Enlightenment. It comes ultimately from the Judeo-Christian tradition of a theodicy, of mankind historically pursuing certain divine goals. That is where it comes from. But in Russia, it takes peculiarly concrete forms because while in the West it still remains something in the realm of theory, which intellectuals, ideologists, professors discuss, in Russia it's actually lived in the way in which people in the West do not live their ideas, not with that degree of intensity, not with that degree of dedication, and not, one may say, with that degree of practical effect, both successful and disastrous.
That talk on the Russian preoccupation with history was by Sir Azar Berlin, formerly Chicheley Professor of Social and Political Theory in the University of Oxford, and now President of Wolfson College and President of the British Academy.